If a player cleans his ball during play of a hole, except on the putting green, he shall incur a penalty of one stroke. That's the rule, Jerry.
But it's just a friendly game. Why do you always have to be such a stickler?
Because that's the way I was raised.
Welcome to Spirit of the Game, brought to you by the Colorado Golf Association. Here are your hosts, Ed Mate and Lewis Harry.
All right, it is another month has gone by, and it's now greening up out there. It's Masters Month, the month of April. How you doing?
Good.
Yep. This is Ed Mate.
Lewis Harry.
And we're here to do another rules chat on the Spirit of the Game. You know, I was watching, some news program, and they had one of the former chief justices on, and he has written a book, and basically he's a self-described pragmatist versus a textualist. And I thought that's a very interesting way of really describing the name of our podcast. Spirit of the Game is really referring to being a pragmatist. And I like to think I'm a pragmatist. Not that these two things are mutually exclusive, but a textualist is somebody who just follows the letter of the law. The Constitution is a pretty old document. The rules of golf are pretty old. Well, they've been updated a lot more than the Constitution. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. So I guess I could say I'm a pragmatist, not a textualist.
I thought you were going to start arguing that the Constitution should go through a revision every 4 years like the rules of golf does.
I think that would be a good thing, actually. But we're an apolitical podcast here, and that's the beauty of golf. We can agree on things, and if there is any area of agreement, we love this game. Some of us may have a deeper love of the rules than others, but I think that's one of the beauties of the game is it brings us all together. So we're going to do this a couple times this year, depending on how the year plays out, but we're going to do a Q1 look back of talk of the tours and notable rules situations that came up over the course of the first 3 months of the season that we think are worthy of further discussion, investigation, debate. And two of them, I think most of our listeners will be well aware of because they really did get a lot of play. The other is a little bit more obscure. I thought it was interesting because it involved one of our former CGA staff members, Robert Duke, our former director of rules and competitions. And it was at the LPGA Thailand. This was back in February. The player was Paddy Tavitanikit, who went on to win the tournament comfortably. It was on the 10th hole. She had asked for relief for a French drain. The ball was apparently, from television, it looked like the ball was laying just fine. I happened to be watching this live because I have nothing better to do. It was about 10 o'clock at night on a Friday or Sunday night. And I texted Robert after this happened to say, well done. I just assumed that. But anyway, the upshot of it is she asked for relief. She claimed she was in a French drain, which is, by definition, an abnormal ground condition. I love having you backing me up, my safety net.
Abnormal course condition would be the terminology today.
See, there we go. So always interrupt me, please. I don't want to have any of my misspeaks get into people's heads. So anyway, denied relief, said did a little probing with a tee or some type of knife or something, could not find any evidence of French drain. Got on the radio to confer with a rover or maybe the advance official to see if there was something there, and ultimately said, I'm sorry, I don't see any evidence. And she then proceeds to hit it to a foot out of this lie that she didn't think she should have to deal with. So what, as you looked at that video, what was your reaction to it? What kind of grade would you give Robert? What do you think our listeners can benefit from that?
So before I give my thoughts, I always, and you've probably heard me say this before, I always hesitate to comment on other rules situations that involve other referees. I'll give my input after I say this, but and especially when someone asks me a question about, you know, a video or something happened where there was a committee conversation and an outcome, I always say I'm hesitant because I'm not a part of that committee. I'm not in that room. I'm not seeing what they're seeing. I'm not having the conversations they're having the conversations. But in this case, with that video, it was really hard to see anything that she was trying to get relief for. From what it sounded like Robert, who was discussing with her, sounded like there was maybe a depression in the ground, which was the cause of her to think that maybe there was something that entitled her to relief with that depression in the ground. But with Robert coming in and, you know, trying to figure out, well, you know, what is she referring to, or what could she possibly be trying to get at in that scenario? I think he did a really good job of, you know, not trying to rush to any conclusion of, well, you know, one, trying to rush to, well, you're not getting relief, this is the end of the discussion, whatever. So he does a really good job of, you know, going through it, trying to probe for himself to see if there's something he's not seeing that she maybe saw. Explain to her that, you know, that's seems to be just a depression in the ground where the ground slopes down. It's not meeting the definition of anything we're giving you relief for, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, the common denominator in all three of these scenarios we're going to talk about here during this podcast is really trying to tease out. We have to interpret. There's an interpretation. The rules are not black and white. They have, the language is black and white, but situations are never aligned perfectly with the language. So there's always is, because again, it's clear. Is this a French train? If it is, you get free relief. Well, there was an uncertainty. In this particular case, the rules official was right there on the spot to make a determination. The other situations we're going to talk about, there was no rules official right there on the spot to make a determination. So it came up later. And again, they have that same common thread of we're trying to determine a fact. And then from there, so facts are elusive sometimes. But again, before we leave this one and move on to the next situation, as a referee, how do you what mental state do you typically, what is sort of your bedside manner when it comes to dealing with a player who's requesting relief? And how do you try to maintain that right balance between being objective, being fair, and also to the extent it's appropriate, be player friendly?
Whether it's a scenario where the player's asking for relief or not, I think any rules scenario you walk into as a referee, you have to go in with an open mind. You know, there's times where you might know the facts going in. If you're getting called in as part of a second opinion, or you got radioed to a situation, you might know the facts already before you're going in, so you might have time to prepare. But if you don't, and oftentimes you don't know what you're getting called into, and you don't know the facts ahead of time, you're almost on a fact-finding mission. You're almost there to try and, one, like I said, go in with an open mind. And two, it's never a bad thing to ask more questions than you might need. I've gone through a lot of videos lately just because we're preparing for our own referee training session with our own CGA referees coming up. I've gone through a lot of videos recently involving player-referee interactions, and the common theme that I keep coming across is that, one, I think a lot of times the referee is quick to jump to a conclusion. And, you know, in the moment, it's easy to do that, but looking from it from a bird's eye view, you know, it's just trying not to jump to a conclusion that, well, nope, you're not going to get relief. That's the end of the story. Don't see anything. That's the end of it. Ruling's over.
Yeah.
It's more just, again, going in there with an open mind, trying to ask as many questions and find out as many facts as you can. And then, again, from there, your knowledge of the rules takes over, and yeah, you kind of play it out from there.
No, I like that a lot, just keeping an open mind. I've always tried to remind myself I'm here to help going in. Mm-hmm. So, and as I've evolved as a referee, that's probably been the single thing that's helped me more than anything. Doesn't change the outcome at all. It just means that your demeanor is a little bit more measured, and you're not, and again, it comes with experience, comes with confidence. So, but keeping that open mind, I think is a good thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go to the next one. And this is one I know our listeners are going to be, because it was well publicized and it was in a notable tournament. It was a high profile PGA Tour event. So it's at the Arnold Palmer Bay Hill Invitational. This is now in March, third round. Wyndham Clark is hit it in the very famous right rough on 18 at Bay Hill. And, you know, the one thing about that particular tournament, the brand of it is they do set it up pretty tough. The greens are firm and fast. The rough is deep. And the camera, no referee involved in this one, zoomed in on Wyndham's ball. He had a sand wedge. He was just hacking it out, not even trying to go for the green. And he, you know, grounded his club pretty heavily behind the ball. And the camera showed the ball moving for sure. The question is, did it move? Because balls can literally move, but not move from a definitional standpoint. In other words, if a ball oscillates, returns to the same position, that ball has not moved from a rules of golf perspective. But if a ball moves vertically downward, even though it's still resting on the same blades of grass, think of a kind of a bird's nest of grass. If that whole nest moves vertically downward, then that ball has moved. It didn't spring back to its same location. So to finish the facts, Wyndham was asked about it in the scoring tent. He was basically quoted in his little presser afterward that he had no idea that he might have done something. And he admitted, wow, that didn't look good. I mean, he went on to say that he thinks the rules are too complicated and they need to be more user-friendly. That makes absolutely no sense to me. I love Wyndham, and he's obviously a Colorado native, and we root for him. But it'd be hard for me to defend that comment. It's like, well, what do you mean? What's complicated about playing the ball as it lies? It's not a matter of complicated. You may feel that way, but I don't see how that connected back to this particular situation. Maybe he was quoted out of context, or who knows. But at any rate, my take on this is I believe the ball moved. Mark Dusbobic was in the TV tower at the time and does a really nice job. He's a PGA Tour rules official, and you could tell he was a little squeamish. And I think he must have gotten on the horn and contacted, you know, his fellow rules officials, and they took a look at it and ultimately decided that the ball did not move. It's a tough call, but I thought it did. What was your reaction?
Well, first reaction is I agree with you. And my initial thought was the ball moved. You got to think of this from the point of, if you look in a Webster's dictionary of the definition of moved, and you look in the rules of golf definition of moved, you're going to find two different definitions. So looking at it through that lens of the rules of golf definition of moved, yeah, I do think the ball did move down, and moving down is changing the location of the golf ball. So I do think it did move. The second half of that was with there was a question about, you know, him with the club in the grass behind the ball, and, you know, maybe tamping the grass down, or the club kind of pushing that grass down behind the ball. And I think Mark Dusbobic gave an explanation of it on the broadcast, whereas, you know, a player is allowed to set the club down behind the ball and let the weight of the club head rest behind the ball. Well, when you grow rough that thick and the grass gets that long, it's really hard for the weight of that club not to push that grass down. So in that case, where a lot of people are up in arms about, well, him, you know, improving his lie or pushing the grass down behind his ball, I'm not really sure there was much there. And it seemed that the rules committee for the Arnold Palmer seemed to agree in that manner, where there wasn't really much of anything there. In terms of Wyndham's comment about the rules are too complicated, well, you want simple or you want fair, because you can't have both. So that's, you know,
yeah,
that's kind
well,
of that, that
well
part
said.
Of it.
I mean, that's a David Stabler line for sure. That's mm-hmm. pretty good and useful to say, because you're right. Simple and fair generally don't go very well together. Anybody who jaywalks goes to jail for 5 years. That's simple.
But I did see fair? I did see somebody. There was some, I don't know where the comment was made, but there was a comment about, you know, oh, do we really need a 200-page rule book of, you know, all this stuff and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, basketball, football, and hockey have pretty thick rule books too, and they have a standard playing field that doesn't mm-hmm. change. The basketball court's 90 feet long anywhere you go. Mm-hmm. Football field's 100 yards long everywhere you go. The hockey ice is the same dimensions.
You don't know what it is?
I don't. I was not a hockey fan, yeah. So unfortunately I don't know the dimensions of that yeah. playing field. But yeah. those are all standard playing fields with a pretty thick rule book. So imagine having to write a rule book for a playing field that constantly changes and is different in hundreds of thousands of places around the world.
Well, and I'm not sure Wyndham is aware of the fact that the rulemakers went through a very exhaustive simplification. They didn't use that term, modernization of the rules, that led to a much simpler rule book than what it used to be, or much more intuitive, a little bit more common sense. So
to this last part, again, going through all these videos recently for our referee training of all these old rulings with involving players and referees going back and forth, and I watched quite a few, and I have watched all the way quite a few of a lot of them prior to 2019 of going through these rulings and how complicated some of these rulings were, mm-hmm. and how sometimes unfair of how the outcomes of these rulings came out to be.
Right.
So, you know, are we in a better spot than we were 10 years ago with the rules? I would probably argue we are.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, you think about all the scoring errors that were resulted in players allowed, you know, weren't disqualified. Think about Lexi Thompson, even though she got four strokes, she was able to play on. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Okay, the third scenario, and this again probably got the most airtime because of the player involved and the tournament. That was the Players' Championship. First round, Rory McIlroy, seventh hole, in a very chaotic round where he made, I believe, 9 birdies or 10 birdies and as many doubles, well, not as many, but shot 65. But during that round, he hit his ball left on 7. And this is, I'd say, right at the top of the list of the most violated rules, the most abused rules or circumvented rules or creatively interpreted rules.
It's top three.
And we talked about this, and I thought, not to pat ourselves on the back, I just watched recently our ball hitting the tree video that we just sent out by email, maybe even this week or last. I thought that was a really good way, and I really liked what you said, 19 out of 20, 95% probability, known or virtually certain for a ball to be in a penalty area to treat it as such. That is not the argument here. There's no question the ball was in the penalty area. The question was, where did it cross the edge of the penalty area? And this was played out in the Golf Channel. The commentator, Johnson Wagner, went back out that evening with 3 golf balls and about threw out his arm trying to replicate the bounce, which I mean, what was he thinking? He could throw a ball as hard as, I don't know. It was a little bit of a stretch, to say the least. But the real highlights were the fact that Jordan Spieth walked over from all the way across the fairway, and based on the tone of voice and his elevated, you know, he's just kind of speaking up because of the distance. It certainly, from the appearance and watching the video, it seemed to be contentious. I'm not sure it was, and I, you know, we rewatched it before we started recording so I could kind of refresh my memory on what exactly occurred. Anyway, the facts are interesting simply because of the players involved in the profile. But the ruling itself is so common, where players are taking, in some cases, egregious liberties with where balls last cross margins of penalty areas. I mean, some of it's purely innocent mistakes, where, you know, a scenario where a player's ball crosses the margin or the edge of a penalty area right in front of the tee, but travels another 200 yards, never even coming close to an edge of the penalty area, and assuming they can drop the ball where it splashed or kind of on an equidistant arc from where it splashed. That's probably the most egregious, but a lot of times if that's the case, it's really ignorance. But this, where did it last cross, is such a problem, and it's significant. When you hit the ball 65 times in a round of golf and you're talking about one stroke, that's a lot. That's a lot of your round that you're talking about, and you're saving that extra stroke by going back all the way to the tee. So it's really important. And so I was really, frankly, pleased to see Jordan Spieth speak up, even if he was just, you know. And again, when we say protect the field, the assumption is you're protecting them from cheating. No, well, that's one way of looking at it. But I think Jordan's tone of voice and his whole demeanor was, I'm protecting you from a possible disqualification or additional penalty from dropping in the wrong place. So just because you're protecting the field, part of the protection of the field is the player involved, so that they don't get in trouble. And I really think he did a good job of explaining that. So anyway, that's just sort of some random thoughts on it. Where the ball struck the ground, whether it actually crossed or not, who knows? I would just say that Johnson Wagner's little science experiment was not very compelling in terms of convincing me that his ball did indeed hit on the higher side of the hill and therefore cross the edge on that side, and which would mean that Rory proceeded correctly. So give me your thoughts.
Yeah, I'm not sure that experiment proved anything with throwing the ball on the hill and letting it bounce. But, there's just a lot of things going on in this ruling. There's, one, the ball in the penalty area, trying to figure out where it crossed. There's Rory's perspective of where it crossed and, you know, from where he was standing on the tee. You got to think with Jordan Spieth and Victor Hovland in this group, you have their perspective of where they think it might have crossed, but they were probably standing to the side of Rory after this ball was made, the stroke the ball was made. So they might have a different point of view from where Rory had a point of view. You have the volunteer that was on the other side of the fairway, because you're not going to put a volunteer on that side up against the penalty area line, because you're probably going to be in the player's way if you put somebody over there. You have a TV camera that didn't capture the right angle from the other side of the fairway, or didn't capture the angle from down the penalty area line. So there's a lot of, you know, you have a lot of information to gather, but none of it's really getting you any further to, you know, figuring out where that ball crossed the penalty area. Ultimately, you know, what it's going to come down to is Rory's reasonable judgment, figuring out where that ball, that the estimation of where that ball crossed the penalty area. Again, he's trying to gather as much information as he can, and Jordan Spieth's trying to offer information and help him make that decision. It's interesting in this case where Victor Hovland is the third player in this group, and you know Victor Hovland was also the player in the Daniel Berger group a couple years ago, albeit that was on 16 of the players where they were trying to figure out the ball crossing the penalty area. So it's interesting that Victor Hovland finds himself in another one of these at the same golf tournament. Again, albeit on a different hole, but it's in a tournament where you don't have the luxury of shot link, TV cameras, volunteers, all the above that the PGA Tour usually has at their disposal. At the club level or at an amateur level, it's, you know, sometimes it's really, really much, pretty much on you to figure it out. And you got to do the best you can, and you got to gather all the information you can. And, you know, maybe like we did in our video, our CGA rules video recently, maybe use a tree to kind of figure out that distance, or use a point, you know, where it lasts, maybe a stake or whatever else you might have seen from your point of view. Again, a lot of times it just comes down to the best we can do in estimating that point.
You know, it's interesting as we think about other sports that are analogous. A couple of things come to mind. I guess they're all involving football. When we're trying to determine, did a player get the first down? Did they break the plane of the goal line? When a punter kicks to the corner, where did it go out of bounds? You're trying to determine in those cases, because you have a very prescribed rectangle to deal with, you know, it's a lot easier, but in some respects, because there's every single eye is on it, there's other challenges that come with that. I've often wondered, why is it that they haven't modernized the chains? Why don't they have lasers that they can shoot across the field, and if it intersects the ball, it would be a first down? I don't understand. It seems like with all of our technology, we still have these chains.
They might have that in development somewhere.
I don't know. And then, you know, as far as breaking the plane or... But I've always often used the coffin corner punt as a good example of what we're trying to determine. And again, the best way to determine by far, and this happened on Saturday, was when Wyndham Clark hit it left on 12 into the penalty area. And the drone or the overhead camera tracked it all the way. And you could see exactly where the ball crossed. And again, I was kind of relieved to see, because he was proceeding on his best estimate. And he and Mark Duzbabic again was in the booth, and he said he's got it exactly right. And I think you could tell in Mark's comments he was a little worried that, you know, again, the good news is if Wyndham drops in the wrong spot and you catch it before he plays a stroke, you can fix that. But again, this is such a, you really have to, the player has to be given enough latitude to proceed, you know, without, and I want to ask you this question. What do the rules say about a player taking relief in this situation and then later evidence proving or suggesting pretty strongly that they dropped in a wrong place, that we now have further evidence. They made the best estimate, and then it turns out their best estimate was not very good. Are they then now subject to penalty if you can? I think I remember some interpretations on this. And if not,
yeah, it comes back to reasonable judgment. The rules are going to accept that reasonable judgment. And at the time, if the player used all the information they had available to them and to the best of their ability,
right,
the rules are going to accept that reasonable judgment. Now, again, this is there's various times in the rules where the word reasonable comes into play. Right, in this scenario, reasonable judgment.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a ball overhanging the hole, you have a reasonable amount of time to reach the hole.
Mm-hmm.
If you're dealing with abnormal course condition relief, you don't get relief for an unreasonable stroke or a clearly unreasonable stroke. So there's a lot of times in the rules where reasonability comes into play, and this is one of those times that if it's reasonable and it's a reasonable judgment that they did the best they could. Now again, if it's discovered that they dropped 200 yards away from where they should have. Was that their reasonable judgment? Mm-hmm. Possibly not.
Well, and again, just take the Rory situation. Well, it could have been because, you know, was it reasonable to assume that his ball crossed the penalty area up there or not? Because mm-hmm. in that case, it would have been 200 yards or more further back, maybe 300 yards.
Yeah.
So again, I can just, as we try to give counsel to tournament players and casual players, what would your advice be on how to do the right thing when it comes to this? And before I let you answer, I'll answer. Always, in my view, just if there's any doubt, just like we talked about on the video, you know, if it's known or virtually certain that your ball did not cross and it's unreasonable, you kind of know that. So don't sully your reputation. And that's kind of what I felt about with Rory. I said, don't sully your reputation off of one stroke. Just, okay. And it feels to me that a lot of players are willing to kind of go too far.
I'll use the example of virtual certainty because it's an easy one to kind of go off of with, you know, figuring out what happened to a golf ball. But if you're trying to do your best in applying a rule or applying that virtual certainty standard, or really, you know, trying to determine where across the penalty area, whatever it might be, you know, with virtual certainty, there's the allowance of some doubt in there. In this case, 5% doubt with virtual certainty. You know, and if you're going through trying to gather that information, trying to make a determination or use your judgments, and if you can think of one or two situations where maybe that judgment goes the other way, or maybe it didn't happen, or maybe it did this, I think you're still in that, you know, virtual certainty realm, or you're still using your reasonable judgment. If you're trying to figure all that information out and you start thinking of 3, 4, 5 different scenarios where something else could have happened, or it could have been this, or it could have been that, I think we're now getting out of that realm. Right. And now maybe you have to think about it a little differently.
Right.
So,
well, we've gone through our list. While we have a few extra minutes here, I want to just ask you about some of the upcoming rules education we're going to be doing. This will go live on Monday with April 1st. So there'll still be some time, I suppose, to sign up for any of our rules education.
We have two left. We have one last virtual hour on, Wednesday, April 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
So no need to sign up. Click the link on the CGA website. Join us at 6 p.m. I think we're talking about local rules for that one.
Okay.
It's the last virtual one of the year. And then we have one last in-person one on April 12th at South Glen Country Club. And again, same CGA rules seminars page on the website. It's a registration link. That, I think, closes a couple days prior to the 12th. So
okay.
Should have enough time to register for that. But two lefts, and then we kind of get into tournament season. So we shift gears from rules of golf education back to running competitions.
Right. Have you been asked any really surprisingly good rules questions at all the seminars you've done so far this spring?
Not at a seminar, but at, well, you know, we always get asked good questions at seminars, but I did get asked a good question over email recently. And it had to do with Stableford, which again, not a really common thing we come across. We only run one Stableford event. It's the Women's Stableford Tournament. We don't run any Stableford events on the men's side or the open side of our CGA championships, but it's a question about Stableford, and yeah, this is a 9-hole Stableford competition, 1 through 9, holes 1 through 9. Player finishes hole 6, gets to the 7th tee, and they know they don't play 7 well. They have never played this hole well. They've never made anything less than bogey on it. They just know that this hole is bad for me. I lose balls here all the time. I don't want to play this hole, so I'm just going to skip it. And I'll walk along with my group and mark my person I'm marking for. And then when we get to 8, I'll continue my round at 8. Question being, with Stableford, it's a form of modified stroke play to where there's certain penalties in stroke play where a breach of that penalty and a failure to correct that penalty results in a disqualification. However, there's certain things in Stableford where that is modified with Stableford where you don't get disqualified, you just get no points. So like failure to hole out in stroke play typically is, you know, if you don't correct failing to hole out, you get disqualified.
Right.
But if you fail to hole out in Stableford, as we all know, with Stableford, if you get to a certain point where maybe you're at double or triple bogey and you're just not going to earn any points, you can just pick the ball up. Same thing with, you know, I forget what the other ones are, but a few other ones where you just don't get the points.
Mm-hmm. Well, wrong ball if you didn't correct it.
Sure. Stuff like that. Yeah. So the question was, do we apply no points to that hole or should this player get disqualified?
For failing to play the round? Is that what would be the reason to disqualify them?
Well, so I don't know how much time we have here. If you have an answer, feel free to email and send me what you think might be the answer.
Yeah.
Well, because I can go back and forth on this. You can say, well, they failed to hole out, just give them 0 points and move on. My thought was that when they hold out on 6, they should have played their next stroke from the 7th tee. Their next stroke they played was from the 8th tee. They played from outside the teeing area and starting a hole. Never corrected the mistake because they went on, played 8, then teed off 9.
So
my thought was they should be disqualified because they never corrected that mistake.
Okay. But again, in Stableford, you just get no points. So would they just get no points for 8 as well?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Do they?
I don't know. All I know about this is, and I know I've probably mentioned it on this podcast before, I am a big believer in Stableford and a very strong opponent of the term Stableford. I wish we would retitle it to points. It's a wonderful form of play because every hole you begin anew and you have a chance to earn more points. That's such a affirming thing. Plus, in this country, points are such a ingrained into our heads. It's a very easy concept for people to understand. And as we try to attract more players to the game, I think playing a points format where you don't have to link together a total cumulative score to you get no points, move on, okay, and then you begin anew. So I'm a big fan of the format. I have to say that's a question that I, again, being a pragmatist, it's crazy to disqualify a player. I think you'd have to be a strong textualist, a letter of the law person.
I think I did find the answer because I never, admittedly, when I was mulling this question, I never went and looked it up.
Okay.
This was just me in my own head. But I think the answer probably would be 0 points.
For the
seventh hole.
Okay.
Yeah, probably would be 0 points.
That seems fair. That seems like
I think what still bothers me about it is that they never put a ball into play for 7. that's what still bothers me about the whole thing, is that with any of those mistakes, with failure to hole out, wrong ball, wrong place, outside the teeing area, or for whatever reason you're playing foursomes Stableford, where you make a stroke in the wrong order, for any of those must-correct mistakes, they all usually involve a ball being in play. And there was never a ball in play for hole 7. So that's kind of where I still get hung up a little bit. Yeah. So,
okay, well, we'll leave it there for this month. Let's see. So we'll be back in May. We're going to have to find a date in April to record sometime during the course of the month. But I'm sure we'll have some. What do you think? Do you think the Masters is going to be uneventful from a rules perspective, or do you think there's going to be?
I think there's always something that comes up.
Yeah. We'll see. Hopefully, right? Don't we want to see a rule determine the outcome? Wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't that make it our jobs here? The content gods, as they like to say, would be on our side. But we'll have to wait and see. Well, thanks for listening. We'll be back in a month.
All right.